The hour 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the Commerce meeting to order. I would be very appreciative if my legislator to the far north, Representative Commerce, said make a motion to approve the minutes.
Having looked over them extensively, I move to approve the minutes from the last meeting of the tax committee.
Representative Smith moves to approve the minutes of February 12th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So we have our agenda before us, and of course, I can't go in order. I don't know if it's ADD or what it is, but we're going to go mix it up a little bit here because we have some bills for people here to testify. And just so we realize on House File 170, David, Senator Hayes, obviously, is not going to Ways and Means, staying right in here. So we will take a look at that last. So we're going to go Gilman, Elkins, Davis. So, Gilman, if you could please join us here. Welcome, committee. Representative Gilman, I will move House File 146. No amendments, members. This is a rerun. We had this bill last year, and we thank Chair Gomez for having it in the House bill. And I think it made it part of the way to the conference committee, but it didn't get well enough. So, again, I'll move House File 146. Motion would be to lay it over conclusion in omnibus tax bill. It's going to be a great tax bill that we all put together in this deal. Okay, so with that, welcome to the committee. You have a testifier, but if you could introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Chair Davids and committee. Happy to be here. Good morning, everybody. I am so excited to talk about this LGA funding that is desperately needed for my little town of Stewart. So you are right. This local government of aid for the city of Stewart was supposed to get through last year, got through in the Senate. Everything was looking good, and then things changed real quickly towards the end of last session with the tax bill in general, the omnibus bill. So my hope is that this bill will move through committee today, and the folks of Stewart's hope this as well. They are now compliant. They were last year compliant. It was a clerical error, and it's been rectified with a new employee that pays attention to detail. So I'd love to have my testifier.
Okay, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Beth Johnston, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities.
Welcome to the committee.
HF 146 is what we commonly refer to as an LGA penalty forgiveness bill. You know, for those who have been on the property tax division and now the full tax committee get to experience these every once in a while. The league works closely with cities to make sure that they can come into compliance and with the state auditor's office when this is going on for their audit requirement deadlines. This last year, we reached out to several cities that had missed their deadline and we're able to get many of them into compliance in time to receive their LGA payments. We will call them, email them, and reach out to their mayors and city clerks to make sure that happens. In the case of Stewart, they were in between city clerks and had missed their deadline. And so this is to just help make sure that they...
Excuse me, what happened?
They were, I believe, in between city clerks.
Okay.
At the time. So, yeah.
And so please continue.
They had missed the deadline, but they are now in compliance with the Office of the State Auditor.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Members, a little history on this. Back in the day, we might have 30 of these come before us, 30 cities, and when they come before the tax committee, I would request, I want to know the reason why, what happened, and I should write a book on some of the things that I'm not going to mention here, but offline we can have a discussion. Just unreal, some of these. But very thankful. Chair Gomez, they've gone down from 30 or 28 to how many did we have last year? We had Stewart. Is that the only one?
Was there one?
Mr. Chair, there might have been one more, but it was apparently at historically lows, which means that, you know, all of our cities who we know really try their hardest to comply with the regulations around LGA are really doing a great job. So.
Well, I thought it was because Chair Gomez knew how to run it. So no,
Mr. Chair, I do run a tight ship. You might have heard. Thank you.
And it's
you know, we had this, I thought we had it done last year, and Representative Gilman really worked on this one. I mean, you were all over the place trying to get this done, and I thank you for that. The issue where I really wish we would have got it last year, it would not have cost anything because it would have been in the LGA for that year. Now it's kind of a new thing, but I think we really need to look at this closely, and I'm certainly supporting it. Any questions for the author or the witness? Thank you very much. Anyone in the audience that wish to testify in favor of the bill? With concerns? Does the department have a position? Yesterday was historic, so we'll let you off the hook on this one. Okay, so with that, I will move that House File 146 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. It's going to be awesome. Okay, item next, Representative Elkins. Welcome to your committee. Representative Elkins will move House File 161. I do not see any amendments. Is that correct, Representative Elkins?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. So Representative Elkins moves House File 161. If you could please present your bill, and I believe we have two folks who would like to testify on this. Is there anyone other than Joshua Hudek and Brian Cook that wish to testify on this bill for or with concerns? Okay, just so we kind of know the lay of the land here. To your bill, Representative Elkins has moved House File 161. To your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is being laid over, so I'm going to kind of do a broad overview. We can come back and discuss the nitty-gritty details later if we want, but that's going to be a new concept to many of the people in the room. And first question one might ask is, you know, what problems with the current property tax system is a land value tax designed to address? So under our current property tax system, if you improve or redevelop your property taxes will go up. And if you neglect your property or leave it value, your property taxes will go down. So the current system has built-in misincentives to neglect structures, engage in property speculation, or if you're a city, engage in what's known as fiscal zoning, which is a topic I could go on for hours about. So what are the goals of land value tax advocates? So proponents of land value taxes want to encourage more efficient land use patterns, land that uses that fully leverage the existing public infrastructure. So if you've got a vacant lot in the city and it's just sitting there undeveloped, it's still taking advantage of the utilities that are been brought to the property, the roads that run by the property, and all of the infrastructure is effectively being wasted. In addition, there are public services like public transit that are much more efficient when the land is developed more intensely, especially with jobs and housing. The other objective would be to improve community vitality by reducing the number of empty lots caused by land speculation. And then there are those who would argue, including me, that it would improve the supply of affordable housing by reducing cities' incentives to engage in fiscal zoning. So are there winners and losers under land value taxes? One of the first questions I always get, and the answer to that is yes. So property taxes on fully developed and well-maintained properties would tend to decrease, while property taxes on undeveloped and underdeveloped properties would increase. So a typical example of the tension that might develop, that might be, say, between the members of the Building Owners and Management Association, BOMA, who represent high-rise office buildings, their property taxes would probably go down, versus members of the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties, which represent mostly low-rise industrial buildings. Their property taxes, at least in a relative sense, might go up. So that would be an example of the kind of tension that you see. So are there any parties that actively oppose land value taxes? Yes, the typical industries that come out in opposition are industries that typically develop at very low densities. The kind of archetypical example would be an auto dealer, where you've got a big lot with a little building surrounded by asphalt with inventory on it. But I would note in a case like that, because they provide a very low tax yield to city, most cities, especially in urban or suburban areas, actively control, limit the access of auto dealers to land through zoning. So I had one mayor, for example, in a suburban Twin Cities community brag to me, actually, that, oh, yeah, we took care of the auto dealership property problem. We only allow auto dealers in industrial zones away from the freeways. So the other parties that actively impose land value taxes are city and county assessors. So you may not have noticed this, but if you look at your own property tax statement, there are already separate valuations there for the land and the structures on the land. But because there's been no historic use for the data about the land use valuations, most assessors don't put much effort into it. In fact, there was an attempt to do a land value tax study in the city of Rochester several years ago, and the study group was forced to abandon the study because the land valuations in the assessor's tax base were just clearly completely messed up. And so they went back to him and asked him, you know, what's the deal with you know, with the land values in your database? And he said, oh, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter, so I just use it as kind of a fudge factor. So those are the two, historically, the two kind of groups that are have been actively opposed. So what would this particular bill do? First of all, it's permissive. Nobody has to do it, but it would enable cities to experiment with land value taxes, including split rural taxation within designated redevelopment in, districts. So the most likely scenario is adoption in an urban city in an effort to discourage land speculation and spur redevelopment in a distressed area of the city. It could also be of interest to a rural small town that is shrinking and experiencing a large number of vacant and boarded up buildings, or in a city like my city, Bloomington, we might eventually come to the point one day where if you've noticed that all around the Mall of America, most of the property is vacant, and it's because the mall directly or indirectly controls most of that land, and it's not in the mall's interest to have, say, competing retail develop on those properties, but at some point the city might come to the point of wanting to tell the mall, hey, guys, it's time to shit or get off the pot. You need to develop this land or we're going to put some.
That's what they would say, not you.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what my father would say, actually.
I didn't hear it.
But, you know, it could be a tool that Bloomington could use to, you know, provide the mall with an incentive to actually do something with those properties. So the epitome of a use case would be, say, the city of Minneapolis, and you're looking at 8 East Lake Street, which was, you know, bombed out during the civil disturbances in the wake of George Floyd's murder. It's now pockmarked with burnt out properties all along it. So the city could establish a land value taxation district along Lake Street and the properties such that the vacant properties, what they've seen is, you know, land speculators swooping down to buy out burnt out buildings, and they'll just sit on those properties indefinitely until the neighborhood starts coming back and they feel they can, you know, realize a profit on the sale of that property. But in the meantime, you know, those properties are just sitting there. They're actually retarding the redevelopment of the neighborhood. By imposing a land value tax district along this stretch, all of the businesses that have reinvested in their properties, helping actually rejuvenate the neighborhood would see lower taxes, whereas the speculators who are sitting on the burnt out properties that are lying vacant would see their taxes go up significantly to make it financially impractical for them to sit on the land and not redevelop it. So that is the essence of what we're trying to do. And in this case, you know, the assessor, you know, shouldn't be opposed because he's going to have to put a land-only, you know, value on all those vacant properties anyway. That will also provide him with the data he needs in order to properly assess the value of the land on the adjoining developed properties. So the burden on the assessor is minimized as well. So that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. Before we go to questions, why don't we go to some testimony here, if that's okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go to Joshua Hudek, Senior Program Manager, Land Use and Transportation. Sir, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record. I feel kind of strange about that sometimes because I just said who it was, and I'm asking you to do it.
I could do that.
Thank you. Thanks for getting me off the hook here.
Good morning.
I've always pondered, if you enjoy wasting time, is it really wasted time? Please state your name for the record.
Food for thought.
That's a profound question, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Chair David and members. My name is Joshua Hudek, again. I'm the Senior Program Manager for Land Use and Transportation at the Sierra Club Minnesota North Star Chapter. We're 50,000 members and supporters across the state. I assume there's a vacant or blighted property in your district. Maybe a half-empty parking lot, abandoned gas station. Towns and cities, large and small, across Minnesota are riddled with properties that land speculators are holding until their value increases. And many of these property owners are faceless, and sometimes even offshore or out of state. While they wait for years, sometimes decades, for their crumbling lots or blighted, underused properties to increase in value, all of our communities suffer. Land value tax is about local control. It's about a policy tool that can help with these situations. It's a shift in policy that incentivizes property owners to use or sell vacant or underutilized sites. Those who build intensively on sites are not penalized with higher taxes, as they are by our current property tax system. Legalizing land value tax can lead to more vibrant, sustainable communities in your district by replacing empty lots with grocery stores, shops, and much, much needed housing. Land value tax would be an optional tool, as Representative Elkins explained, for municipalities across our state to use if they choose. Give this a chance. Vote yes on House File 161 and give local municipalities more control to help improve their communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying. Question I have is looking at how cities would use this to entice multi-billion dollar corporations. People come in to buy big, you know, put in big warehouses, big data centers or whatever, where they would come in and say, for the first 5 years, we're only going to charge you for the property of the property tax on the land, and we're going to give you a tax break because we're not going to take into account the warehouse or the business. The question is would this then allow also the businesses to put in time frames to say for the first 5 years we're going to tax you at this, and then after 5 years we're going to tax you at the full value of the property or the property?
I can probably.
Mr. Hudek? Or Representative Elkins?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I think those kinds of arrangements are usually negotiated planned unit development agreements between the city and the development entity. And I don't think they would really be affected by this, though. I mean, part of the negotiated agreement could be similar to a land value tax.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you. So, I mean, I understand what you're trying to do, which is to create density, essentially, and development. What about tax-exempt properties? Does it have any effect on that? So hospitals, schools, anything?
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you. And then what about, like, there's a lot in suburban communities, especially. There's undeveloped property that is ag typically, but it's zoned commercial or zoned It's guided. I'm sorry. It's typically zoned ag, but it's guided for something of a much higher use. How would this affect the zoning versus the comp guide designation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, something I haven't thought about. I will, though.
Okay. thank you. I know this. We're going to lay this over, so maybe we can talk. Thank you.
Any further questions for, at this point, the testifier, Mr. Hudak? Okay, thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate it. We have Mr. Brian Cook. I'm not going to say what you do. You tell me what you do.
Yeah. It's changing.
Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Davids, members of the Taxes Committee. My name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Tax, Fiscal Policy, and Elections for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Chamber is a statewide organization representing more than 6,300 businesses of all sizes who employ more than 500,000 employees. We support policies that best position our state for future success by advancing a competitive business climate to encourage a growing economy, to increase private sector investment, entrepreneurship, and talent recruitment and retention. This morning, I would like to share some of our thoughts on House File 161. While we understand the problem Representative Elkins is seeking to solve, we do have some concerns about the way the bill could create some unintended consequences for cities and property owners. Minnesota has made progress over recent years in making our business property taxes more competitive through reductions in the overall state property tax levy and the elimination of the automatic inflator. However, these taxes are still a high fixed cost of doing business with a higher burden compared to the national average in our neighboring states. Our concern is that allowing cities to create land value tax districts would introduce another mechanism for shifting property tax burdens onto commercial and industrial properties beyond the use case envisioned by Representative Elkins. One of the proponents of land value taxes is the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. In 2004, they published a working paper titled Implications of a Split Rate Real Property Tax, an initial look at three Virginia local government areas. While it's not able to provide us with a direct apples-to-apples comparison, it can give us at least a little bit of insight into how land value taxes might play out in Minnesota if used at a broad scale. The working paper demonstrates some of the shifting that could occur. They note that the business tax share in all three localities they studied would increase. In Chesterfield County, commercial properties, which are 3% of the land, already pay 12.8% of the total property tax under the current system. With a split rate tax system that includes a land value tax, their proportion of the tax burden would rise 38.2% to 17.2%. So any sort of similar shift in Minnesota would be especially concerning, as businesses in Minnesota already pay a disproportionate share of the property tax burden. Commercial and industrial properties represent 11% of the market value, but pay 25.5% of the net property tax. So the Chamber opposes any additional property tax shifts to commercial industrial properties. We have a little bit of concern about how House File 161 could create a new mechanism for that shifting at the local level, again, beyond the scenarios that Representative Elkins envisioned. So I appreciate your time this morning. Look forward to the continued conversation with Representative Elkins and the committee on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Questions for Mr. Cook? Okay, anyone? Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to puzzle through this. So the land, maybe this is for Representative Elkins. Mm-hmm. The land itself would be taxed at a higher rate, especially if it was vacant. So I'm not understanding how that cost could shift to other properties.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I mean, the devil is in the details on, mm-hmm. on these. So it depends. It would depend on the exact balance of land taxes versus structure talents and what the rates would be. So it's really hard to calculate out until you have a specific proposed rate structure in front of you. You can say in a general sense that certainly that more intensely developed properties will fare better and less intensely forms of development will be disadvantaged in general, but you can't really, you know, figure out exactly what the effects are until you see the proposed rate structure. So I, in my presentation, used the example of BOMA members versus NIOP members. Relatively speaking, certainly BOMA members, because they're generally higher tax, you know, higher density office buildings, would fare better than NIOP members. But in the overall balance of things, I my gut feel is that in most land value or split roll taxations, NIAP members would probably come out about the same. It would be the really low density developments, like maybe big box retail or auto dealers, as I mentioned, that are probably the kinds of businesses that would fare worse.
Chair.
One follow-up question. Thank you, sure. Chair Davids. So with thinking of all the, you know, quite a few of the office buildings we have right now that are vacant in some of our cities, mostly in Minneapolis and St. Paul, that are high density, tall buildings, lot floors, if they would fare better than if there is a land tax, because that the land underneath on vacant properties would be taxed more to make up that difference. They wouldn't be affected by having a vacant building as much as they are now.
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, or Representative Uwaka, this is a scenario that I've been thinking about. And I think that it, all else being equal, it would tend to buffer cities against those loss of value on the structure, because the land really isn't any less value, and it's only the structure that is. So the relative loss of property tax value under a split roll taxation scheme would probably the buffer the impact on cities.
Chair Davids, just thank you for one more question. This is
sure,
it.
Chair
so
Yakin.
That way, if it's not affecting the, it's not shifting onto the individual homeowner properties as much as it would if we have the tax structure we have with vacant buildings right now, and encouraging with the land value tax to build property, we're seeing this tremendous shift. I mean, our warehouse property value is going up, yeah, as we do a lot more things online, but because of that, with the office buildings losing that value for the city is now being shifted onto either smaller business owners or our housing. So it's an intriguing idea. I still am trying to figure out how to interact with tax increment financing and some of the other abatement things we have, but we can talk offline about that.
Mr. Chair, you're thinking about this the right way. These are all different things that will come into play. But I think that, again, to the extent that we're now seeing a reduction in the value of office structures, this would help buffer that, because the land, which isn't changing as much, would be a bigger factor of it. So there'd probably be less shifting to homeowners. As you observed, the value of NIAP-type properties is going way up, and so a typical owner of an office industrial property, a low-rise, is probably seeing an even bigger shift than a homeowner is right now. In fact, I spoke with NIAP representatives just the other day about this very topic.
Any other questions for Representative Elkins? Does the department... Oh, Representative Lee. Sorry, can't see you there.
That's okay. I'm also very short. so I appreciate it. Thank you, Chair. So Representative Joachim asked a question that I wanted to, similar to what I wanted to ask, but just wanted to highlight that in St. Paul and a lot of major cities, we do have a lot of like vacant, really tall buildings. So I'm going to shift my question to just focus more on small businesses. In my district, we have a lot of vacant lots next to then some buildings that are owned by small businesses. And what I found out is there are a lot of out-of-state companies that own land in Minnesota that really have no incentive to develop them, right? And they just wait and wait, and you see the empty lot or like the empty grass next to all of the buildings that our business owners, our community members have invested in. And so my question is for Rep. Elkins. The way I understand your bill would work is it would make sure that whether, it's this offshore company or, corporation in Pennsylvania somewhere that owns land in our districts versus small business owners, this would make sure that they pay the same property tax so that the incentives would be the same to either develop the land or sell it versus waiting for the value of the land to increase later and make money off of our communities that, we're actually investing in. Can you explain, is that what you're trying to fix here? Is that the problem?
Yeah. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, my favorite example of this is the land that the Twin Stadium now sits on. So that land was owned by basically an investment LLC for decades. They earned enough from surface parking to pay the property taxes every year. So they had, no fiscal pressure to, develop that land. So they just sat on it and sat on it. It was valued at like $1 million, $2 million for all of these decades. And then all of a sudden it was identified as a good site for the Twin Stadium. And all of a sudden it was worth $20 million. Cha-ching. So that's probably the worst example that I could cite. But on a smaller scale, you can look around, downtown Minneapolis in particular, where there are still surface parkings lots on very prime real estate in downtown Minneapolis. And again, as long as the property owner can cash flow just by using the land for surface parking, they're happy to just keep on sitting on it until somebody comes along and offers them an obscene amount of money for that property.
Representative Lee?
That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Any other questions for either Mr. Cook? Let's go with Mr. Cook right now. Okay. I think we're good.
Good.
Now, did I ask if the department has a you don't care? No, you care deeply, just... You don't have any questions? Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay, so with that, we'll go to member questions directly to Representative Elkins, if there are any more. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I always enjoy your ideas and the conversations you bring to the legislature. I am concerned about the shifting. That's my main concern, and I would have to, do a lot more thinking and analysis about it to really understand it. But I did, have the League of Cities taken a position? Have the small cities taken a position?
Representative Elkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins. Not that they have come to me and to discuss.
Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And secondly, I did wonder in some other areas of the state where there are big tracts of land, ag, or especially mineral properties, where they're already taxed in a certain way to benefit schools, how would this impact those?
Representative Elkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, yes. So this is permissive. It would be a municipal authority. And I'm having trouble imagining a scenario where a city would employ the tool in that kind of a scenario.
Representative Robbins?
I'm done, thanks.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, before I move this to be laid over, do you have a question?
Nope.
Okay. I'm kind of intrigued by this. I mean, I think there's some real potential on this, but there are groups that do have concerns, and I hope that you will talk to them, work with them, see if we can work something out here, because I see where you're headed with this, but I can understand the concerns that we had in testimony today, too. So with that being said, Representative Elkins moves that House File 161 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Okay, item next would be the... Totally and completely non-controversial, cost the state nothing, because we don't care about that. So I will move from the chair seat here, House File 170, and what this bill does. Well, let's have House Research, nonpartisan, if you can describe what I'm doing here.
Mr. Chair and members, so House File 170 would reduce the rate under each one of the rates in the bracket structure of the estate tax by 1.6 percentage points over a period of 10 years until each one of the rates hit zero. And so the lowest rate would hit zero first, and the entire process would take between 7 to 10 years for each one of the rates.
Okay, thank you. And just a little history here before we go in. I have no one here to testify. Nobody really wanted to. But A little history here. Back in 2011, when I was so fortunate to become the tax chair, working with my friend Governor Dayton, the estate tax was kind of a big deal back then because I think federally it was $5 million, and in the state of Minnesota it was $1 million. And that really hurt a lot of my constituents, farmers. And the governor really didn't like me, or my idea. He likes me, but he didn't like my idea in that, you know, you're David, you're just, this goes way back. You're just supporting the rich and, you know, all that, that whole story. So I talked to the governor. I said, Governor, I said, do you consider 160 acres, a farmer that has 160 acres, is that a big business that needs to be penalized by the estate tax? Well, what do you mean? I said, well, right now, if I sold my farm, let's say, $1,200 an acre, but then I think I said 10, that's $1.6 million on a quarter section. I would have to sell some of the land. Well, I wouldn't, but a person possibly in that scenario would have to sell land to pay the estate tax. Really? On a quarter section? And so the governor was very kind, and we worked together. And what we did was we moved it up to, I think it was $5 million if the farm was sold and it stayed in the family. We put, you know, guardrails. Or a small business that was sold to a family member. So that's why that happened. And so that was up to, Mr. Klayman, what is it for small business farms now?
Mr. Chair, the exclusion for qualified farm property and qualified small business property is $2 million.
Okay, that got up to $2 million, but for a farmer, a farm family, or a small business, I thought it was more than $2
million. Mr. Chair, that would be in addition to the $3 million general exclusion under the estate tax. So
that's up to $5 million.
Okay. Correct, Mr. Chair.
So that did help a lot of people, and people across the state have thanked me for that because they were able to keep the farm in the family because of that very reason. So I don't want to get the whole thing going about this is for the rich and all that kind of stuff today. If we can avoid that, it's not going to Ways and Means. But this does affect my constituents and it affects your constituents, but especially my constituents. Where's my district? I border Iowa and Wisconsin. And Mr. Klayman, does Iowa have an estate tax at all? I should have told you what questions I was going to make. I'm sorry. Mr. Klayman. And we can look a little bit, or let me ask this question. How many states have an estate tax?
Mr. Chair, there are 17 states that currently have an estate or an inheritance tax. And as I recall, I believe Iowa's is phasing out for estates of decedents in 2026. If that's incorrect, I'll correct the record.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Klein. I don't mean stump the House research person today. I don't want to do that at all. But in fact, very seldom can you actually do that. So that being said, what this bill will do, it phases out the estate tax in the state of Minnesota. And the other thought I've had, because I've given this a lot of thought, I've given House floor speeches on how there should not be a estate tax for anybody, because I've always thought, you go out there, you work your tail off, you earn a bunch of money, now you got this estate, you pay taxes on all the way along the trail of your building your estate, and then you're dead, and we hit you again. I mean, that's just not very nice. That's not Minnesota nice at all. So why would we have people build up their states, they pay taxes, tons of taxes on that money over the years, and then you die and we hit you again? That's just nasty, in my opinion. So that's why we have the bill here. Let's phase it out. Can we afford it? We don't care about that. Right now, what's the price tag on that? What's
$200 million in the Albanian?
Well, that's reasonable. So it'd be my intention just to lay this one over, and we'll have to try and fit $200 million in the tax bill. Chair, go. Knock yourself out, huh?
Okay. Good luck to us all.
Any questions on the chairman's bill? We do have somebody here. Okay, I'm sorry. I got somebody testifying on my bill. I'm excited about that. Hunter Peterson, if you could please come forward and give us your testimony. And I see your Farm Bureau. Oh, this would be really good for Farm Bureau. members. State your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Davids. For the record, my name is Hunter Peterson, and I serve as the public policy specialist at Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. Just wanted to say that on the record. On the agenda, it says I'm with insurance. I'm not. I'm with.
So, Mr. Peterson, you're the Federation division. You're not the insurance, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Okay. Yes. So we're founded in 1919. We are a grassroots general farm organization. We're the largest in Minnesota. We have over 31,000 family farm and ranch members. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of your bill today, Mr. Chair. You said it pretty well, but estate taxes are a particular concern for farm and ranch families because they're based on the market value of assets. Given the consistent appreciation in agricultural land and assets, market value can be very high for farm and ranch families. A limitation on the estate tax exemption means that each year, fewer and fewer farm families will be protected from the estate tax. And this is a clear risk to the continuity of family farms. So, for example, let's say your family owns a 500-acre crop farm. And for background, the average farm in Minnesota right now is about 400 acres. But the requirement to be considered a farmer in Minnesota is that you only have to have $1,000 in gross income a year. So I've heard some folks say if you sell two horses and a load of hay, that makes you a farmer in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Just a little background there. So that average is perhaps skewed downwards a little bit, but with that, you know, it's not uncommon to see farmland, especially with good quality soil, go for, I don't know, $10,000 to $13,000 an acre even. It's incredible. So if the owner of that said farm passed away tomorrow, the value of that estate would be valued at $5 to $6.5 million, depending on your per acre price. So you'd be maxing out or even exceeding the current estate tax exemption that we have. And that's before even including any equipment or livestock. So if that estate ends up being worth $6.5 million, they're going to get hit with a $200,000 bill. Farmers' assets are illiquid, so they might not. There's a good chance they don't have the cash to make those payments. And as you alluded to, options like selling part of the farm or equipment or livestock jeopardizes the viability of the operation. And ultimately, if that estate tax bill makes the farm unviable, then that just contributes to continued loss of family farms and the increase in agricultural consolidation. So Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation strongly supports phasing out the estate tax to preserve family farms and ranches. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill today and understanding that's going to be laid over. I'd ask for the committee's future support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions for Mr. Peterson from the Federation? Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just simple questions, because I actually grew up on a farm in the summertime as a farmhand for a family farm. And help me out here. A lot of our farms today in Minnesota, are they could consider family farms, or would they consider LLCs? Where are we at with that? Because I think there's some questions that I'd just like to know.
Mr. Peterson.
So in Minnesota, we kind of have a special, I believe it's statute 500.24 lays out family farms and specifically family farm LLCs and partnerships. So there is certainly a way that that works there. But what I will say is that in the United States, 90 to 95, depending on the estimate of farms are family farms. And I am sure that is also true in Minnesota.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so when we're saying family farm, we're saying that basically the family centennial farms, whatever, when they control that farm through generations and it's in that family, it's not Hewitt Farms LLC. It's Joe's farm and it's been in the family for, that's what a family farm is still, or did we change it because of corporations and stuff like that?
Mr. Peterson.
So again, I wish I had the specific section of statute in front of me, but it's even small farms, they do use it. It is actually called a family farm LLC, I believe, in that piece of statute. But it's common use in the sense of, you can include multiple family members in the ownership, and it's not just one individual. But yes, family farms that, you know, perhaps have been in the family for five, six generations for a long time, yes.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, this might go to you. So I, again, not being new to the tax committee, and I'll curiosity here. So is a corporate farm dealt with differently than a individual family farm?
Mr. Klayman, we've got corporate farms, we've got family farms, we've got, do we have any laws against foreign ownership of farmland in Minnesota? Some states do. That was about eight questions there that I didn't brief you on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, the qualified farm property subtraction, which is the additional $2 million subtraction, would have to comply with the Corporate Farm Act under Section 500.24 that the testifier referred to. As far as the other questions, I'd have to. That.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the clarity. I look forward to hearing more about it. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Peterson from the Farm Bureau Federation? Now, Farm Bureau Federation of Minnesota?
Yep, Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation.
Or AF, not the American Farm Bureau Federation.
We are, we're essentially a subsidiary of the American Farm Bureau, so.
Gotcha, but you're Minnesota?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question. You mentioned the average farm size as 400 acres. Now, that takes into account very large farms as well. Do you know what the median farm size would be?
Mr. Peterson.
Unfortunately, I don't. And when I was trying to put this together, I tried to find that, and I couldn't. But so, Representative Smith, I would also be interested in knowing what that number is. But I don't have it on hand, unfortunately.
Good question there. Mr. Klayman, to the Smith question. I'm not going to put you on the spot.
If you find the answer, please follow through that.
Any other questions for Mr. Peterson? Okay, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone that would like to testify against the chairman's bill? I don't see anyone. The department? Okay. So with that, if there's any other questions for the author, Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you. First time here. I need to turn this on. Okay.
Nope, you're good.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Also newbie to the tax committee and curious if you can help us understand with the estate tax, how much is collected in revenue, and then how many of the estates that we're talking about are actually subject to the tax?
Mr. Klayman? Questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Templin, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can answer the first part of the question about how much the estate tax collects. And in your packets, you'll see there's a revenue estimate, and that information is included in the revenue estimate. It says that estate taxes in fiscal 26 generated about $280.2 million. And it increases to, it's forecast to increase to $310 million in fiscal 25. And estate taxes are deposited into the general fund. The other question about estates, I will defer to Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Klayman, to the Kozlowski question.
Mr. Chair, it's a small percentage, but we don't have the number right now. But we can follow up. We're actually right now trying to get that information. So,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Representative Kozlowski.
Yeah, quick follow-up. Thank you, Chair. And then just curious in terms of the revenue that is collected. I heard you say it's deposited into the general fund, but can you give us a sense of what types of programs or areas that those funds collected would have an impact if we stop collecting that, if we phase it out? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Kozlowski. I'll answer that one. If it doesn't go in the general fund, there's that much less money in the general fund for everything the general fund pays for. So it's, yeah. Okay. With that, I will renew my motion.
Whoa. Oh, yeah. Well, I think Representative
Smith.
And then, but I'd like some closing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good effort. That was a good try, Chair.
Nice try, Mr.
Chair. That was sneaky. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair David. So opening question is, so we talked a lot about family farms, exempting them, and you talked yourself about tools we have in our toolbox as a tax committee if we wanted to address that problem that you yourself used in that 2017 tax bill. We could change the deductions. We could change on primary residencies within families. We could change the requirements of family farms, how they are eligible for this. But this is a complete reversal of the estate tax. So it might help some of the people that you mentioning, but it's also helping the exceedingly wealthy when they are passing on their incredible fortunes to whoever they choose. So why a complete reverse? First question, just like why a complete getting rid of this tax instead of those particular levers that you've used before?
Right. No, that's a very, very, very good question. The exceedingly wealthy, they're not paying it anyways because they have these people called accountants and lawyers, and they're not paying it, okay? What I'm directing this at, and I would like to see some numbers as this moves along. Again, we're not sent it to Ways and Means or anything. I'd like to know how what the size of the farms are that would be able to take advantage of this. The big guys, they've got that's what they pay those lawyers for and accounts. But what I see in my district is a lot of not real big farmers really getting burned. And that's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about those folks. And also, I think I mentioned the premise that I don't think there should be an estate tax. I've said on the House floor before the estate tax is evil because you're taking money that's already been taxed, somebody's dead, and you stick them again. That's the estate tax, okay? So do some really, now this is for the family farms here, and like I said, the big ones, they're not paying, well, some might if they didn't, you know, when some of our big rock stars and folks in the state pass away and you have a will, the state makes out like bandits on them, you know? So what I'm trying to help is the farmer, 300 to 400 acres, it applies to everyone. My bill, it's not a reversal, it's an elimination. So, but that's my theory. There's a distinction without a difference, but I'm against the estate tax, and that's what this bill does.
So follow-up question on that, because you brought up Iowa, which I think is interesting, because I was going to bring that up as well, because you're right, they don't have a state tax, but they do have an inheritance tax, which tries to cover some of the same area from a different discussion. Does your aversion to the passing of wealth between generations extend to the inheritance tax as well?
I'm against the inheritance tax, too. And see, I'm really conflicted here because that senator from Ankeny is in my head because we may be part of Iowa. So then I and Mr. Klayman gave me this, that Iowa, theirs goes away 2025, right? Oh, in estate or inheritance. Do they have an estate tax?
They have an inheritance.
Yeah.
That goes away? Oh, I have to reconsider my position on that acquisition. Representative Smith.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess you stated your position firmly on this, so I'll state mine that I'm very for this. There is an incredible amount of wealth that is about to transition. $20 trillion or more over the next couple decades. And it is continually, I talked about this yesterday, being focused on fewer and fewer people, and less people are having access to that wealth. And a transfer of wealth between generations based on circumstances of your birth, we have a name for that. It's called aristocracy. And it's something that our founders were exceedingly against, because they saw it as a complete expansion of inequality in our society. And that's what's happening. And our tax system is set up to do this. If you inherit wealth from someone, you immediately don't have to pay taxes on the unrealized gains from the person during their life. You talked about paying taxes all of their life, but if it's not realized in the time of their life, when the inheritor gets that, they don't have to pay those taxes that were not taxed in the first place. I have a bill to correct that. Hopefully we can talk about it later in this committee. And the foundational principle of our country is, as even part of your argument, is that when you work hard, you should be able to benefit from that work. But also, no man is an island. We all work in a state, in a government, in a country where we rely on one another. No one reaches these heights of wealth without public roads, public education, employees. The list goes on and on, from water pipes to sewer pipes, that we pay for through collective action. And so to allow people simply without any sort of thought to keep that wealth away from the community, I think is wrong. As you said, your position that you think this is wrong, I'm on the opposite side of this, is wrong. So this is laying over, so we're not voting on this today, but I will say clearly that I am against this. But also, on the same side, as I said at the beginning, I think there are levels, if you're really concerned primarily about the family farms, that we can talk about, that I'm willing to talk about. But I think the completely doing away with the estate tax, especially at a time when wealth is about to transfer between generations at a rate we have not seen in human history, is irresponsible at best.
Thank you. And I just want to clear the record for the committee. The founders of our country did not support the estate tax. I was in the legislature then, and they did not support the estate tax, just to clear the record on that.
Chair, Smith. Sorry, real quick.
I shouldn't have said that.
Got some quotes coming.
Yeah. A power to dispose of estates forever is manifestly absurd. Thomas Jefferson. And I have a whole, I'm not going to read them all here, but they were exceedingly concerned about this because that was the world that they lived in, where people whose names were marquises or counts or lords or ladies had all the money and everybody else worked within the lands and wealth that they owned. And we don't want to return to that.
But Representative Smith, it was not in statute. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Appreciate that. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. This might be maybe a question for nonpartisan staff, but there seems to be claims made earlier that, you know, this proposal before us, your bill, is solving the problem of double taxation. But it was my understanding that we don't tax unrealized gains. And so just wanted to make that point clear, and I don't know if maybe Mr. Klayman or Mr. Swanson.
Well, certainly I'll take that. You are correct on it. That's the one area, unrealized gains. And the other situation, I do estate planning for folks too, so I know how to get people out of this stuff. and so that's one area where you got me. Unrealized gains are not taxed at this point, and if there's something we put in a law where those would be taxed, cool.
Oh.
No, seriously. No.
We'll talk. We'll talk. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, this is very important. Mr. Chair, this is very important. This is very important.
Not while you're living. But think about that, how crazy that is.
Stepped up basis at death.
You're going to... I love stepped up basis.
Well, I know
basis.
You love it, but we can undo it.
Well, no, we can't. So when our good friend President Biden was talking about getting rid of stepped up basis, I had to go to the emergency room. My heart was having problems. But with that being said, in fact, that was pointed out to me. I've been working on this a long time. The late Senator Dianne Loeffler, a very good friend of mine in tax committee, at one time when I made the statement, well, you work your whole life, pay taxes along this all the way, and then you never get taxed on it, she said, well, unrealized capital gains. Now, I can't even fathom going down the road of, like, taxing unrealized gains in people's IRAs and retirement accounts and things like that. That just... How would you even do that? They don't have the money now. So you're going to tax them? Well, that's a whole other issue, and I shouldn't even said that. Okay, so with that being said, can we wrap it up with who else do we have here? Representative Lee, you still have the floor. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay, Chair. I just wanted to make that connection and actually just make sure folks understand. I don't think we're double taxing folks, but I want to close now so that the lead can say her stuff.
No, you are correct. A lot of areas of wealth people have been taxed on, but not unrealized gains. You are correct on that. And for the record, I'm glad you said that. Representative Harder.
I don't know about that one.
Thank you, Chair Davids.
I am your small farmer. And I just have to say that in some ways I feel like I'm being attacked. I might have land that does equal money, depending upon if I sell it. But that doesn't mean that I have the cash on hand to pay for all these taxes. We are overtaxed in this state, and it's not just this tax. It's property tax. It's every tax that I pay to produce food or grain that feeds America. And I'm growing tired of constantly feeling like I'm being attacked for doing the right thing. I work hard for what I have. On my family farm, which my family nearly lost, my first job, I think I was four. That job was in the field pulling weeds. I don't forget those hard times. I don't forget the fact that my family nearly lost the farm that they had gotten from their parents. And I am gracious to my parents that I was able to obtain their farm, which I hope to pass on to my child. But to go on about how farmers are rich, that just isn't so. Our profit margins are tight, and I mean really tight. And here's going to be an example. So last year on my farm, our farm, too much rain, then not enough rain, way too much wind, hail. So I read a report that said that, I'm just going to take for corn, for example, that the average in Minnesota was something like 174 bushels per acre. I think ours is 110. Tell me, how much of a profit did I get? When I'm faced year after year that if I don't have enough money in the bank for these inputs, do I have to sell an acre to survive? I really don't want to sell my land, seriously. I'm a third generation owner of my land, and it's a legacy. And every farmer that I know in my district is the same way. I appreciate bringing forth any bill to lower taxes. We are taxed too much, and we do provide a lot of things that maybe we should and maybe we shouldn't. I work hard for what I have. And I'm just not going to sit in any committee anymore and listen to the attack on farmers. I've had it. We are good people. We work hard. And it's just sort of frustrating. And I just appreciate, Chair, that you gave me the time to just sort of elaborate on that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Representative Harder. And to correct the record, when we're talking about the unrealized capital gains, they should be taxed when they're realized. And not until then. Because how would you pay the tax on money you haven't received? So, that being said, we'll wrap it up with Chair Gomez. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some very brief comments, but then you started talking about unrealized capital gains, so here we go.
Chair Gomez, could we stick to the bill? didn't, but could you?
Mr. Chair, no, I can't. Thank you for asking, not today. So, first of all, on the issue of unrealized gains, the unrealized gains that are not taxed are the unrealized gains of the wealthy. Because the unrealized gains of working class and middle class people are taxed via the property tax. The only asset that most people own is their house. Okay? The only asset that most people will ever own or will ever be able to pass on to their heirs is their home, their homestead. And guess what? Every single year, that asset that is the only asset of most middle class and working class people is taxed. And part of the calculation is the unrealized gain on the house, because the value of your home factors into property taxes along with the classification rate.
So actually, in our country, it is only the unrealized gains of the extremely wealthy who are heavily invested in the stock market that isn't taxed. And this argument that we hear, oh, well, you know, if I have all of these investments in the stock market and I pass them on to my heir, they would have to liquidate some of those assets in order to pay the unrealized gain. I mean, sure, that could be a difficult thing for somebody, but people who own homesteads have to pay on their unrealized gains every single year. And we don't hear this same cry from people about, like, how could you possibly pay a couple $1,000s of unrealized gains on your homestead? Chair Davids, you may be surprised to know that some of my very best friends are rich, not just you. But I have a friend who's wealthy, who's a multimillionaire, and he told me that he was buying a second home. And I it was a few $100,000, kind of like a home out in the country or whatever for his family. And I was like, oh, are you going to pay cash for it? And he laughed at me. He just was like, are you kidding? Pay cash? Like, total poor person fumble. You would never pay cash when you could get a mortgage. You would never do it. Because in order for him to pay cash for his $300,000 house, he would have to liquidate $300,000 of his stocks, pay capital gains tax on that. But if he gets a mortgage to buy his $300,000 house, not only does it not count as income, but he gets to write off the interest deduction on his taxes. And so this is what is commonly referred to as buy, borrow, die. I didn't know about this, right? Because it's not how I grew up. Khalid's nodding. She knows. Khalid buys, borrows, and hopefully will never die. But no. Okay, but what this is, right?
I don't like the die part.
No. What this?
And because you get stepped up.
What this is, right, is the wealthy. You buy stuff. You invest in stuff. You buy property. You borrow against it. If you need cash, you don't liquidate your asset. You borrow against it. And then not only does you borrowing against your asset not count as income, you often get tax benefits for doing that borrowing. And then when you die and you pass it on to your heirs, you pass along the stepped up basis in the value. And so you never pay on it. And so that's what smart rich people do, right, Chair Davids? You buy, you borrow, and you die.
Madam Chair, I never said I was smart.
you might work for smart rich people, though. That was the word. So but I hope that we can get into more of this conversation, because when you explain to people, when they hear about this, you know, at first it's like, God, stepped, you know, paying on unrealized gains, like paying on money that you haven't actually, like, that you don't have in your hands. That's absurd. But we literally do it every year in property taxes. It's just about what the asset is. And it's just about whether we are taxing the unrealized gains on the assets of the wealthy or the assets of regular working class and middle class people. So, but now I'm going to go to my brief comments about your bill. Thank you.
Chair Gomez, so, you can talk as long as you want.
We have this room from 6 p.m. to midnight tonight.
And we'll be here.
All right. So I'm not in the habit of quoting myself, but I'm going to go back to, I said some really smart stuff on Tuesday, though. So I'm going to go back to two things that I said in our first meeting on Tuesday, though, seriously. The first is to the public, to the dozens of people that are watching this right now. I said, you will see what efforts are serious based on whether we lay the bills over or whether we pass them out of committee. Because there's no majority, there's no 68 vote majority in the House for the next 5 weeks. This bill is being laid over. This bill is a serious bill. And what we've laid over so far, we had Gilman's LGA forgiveness today, land value tax. We laid over attachments and appurtenances. We laid over some construction sales tax exemptions from yesterday. And the drug stamp. We laid over the drug stamps. But this, as we talked about, is a $200 million cost in the outbiennium, in the tails. I don't know if you call it the outbiennium, 2028, 2029, $200 million. So this is a serious proposal. This is a proposal that we're bringing into the real conversation that's going to be happening. And the other thing that I talked about during our introduction was, you asked us why we're here. Like, why do we care about taxes? Why do we care about tax policy? And I told you that that the interests of the wealthy and of corporations have been amply represented in the development of the Internal Revenue Code and the Minnesota Tax Code. And that I'm here to fight for working class people, for working people, for people who are struggling, for middle class people, for regular people who are having trouble affording their lives. And so this is an example of how that happens, of how the interests of corporations and the wealthy are served bit by bit, exemption or exclusion, by bracket change, rate cut, these little kind of marginal moves that get made. But this is how it happens. This is how it happens. The heirs and heiresses that are impacted by this tax will still be multimillionaires. This is the single most progressive tax in our tax code. For new members, if you haven't checked out the Tax Incident Study, which is a publication put out by the Department of Revenue every other year, you should really look at it. It goes through each of our taxes and talks about how progressive or regressive they are, which means when you go up the income scale, do you pay a greater percentage of your income? And this is the single most progressive tax in our tax code. And one of the first big dollar serious items we're bringing into negotiation is this. And so we can say whatever we want. Like, I can tell you, I'm here to fight for working class people. I'm here to fight for middle class people. And you can say the same. But we'll show you who we're fighting for with the bills that we bring forward. We will show you. And this shows us something that I think we all need to make note of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, are there any other comments? I never went to the department on my bill. Any comments from the department? You want to get in this one? I don't blame you. Okay, with that being said, next week's schedule, Tuesday, we're very fortunate to, and thank you, Chair Gomez, for those comments. I will move to lay House File 170 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax, which would be a great tax. Okay, so with that, Tuesday, Department of Revenue, agency presentation. So we're doing, Chair Gomez.
I just want to ask a question about schedule when you're done.
Oh, certainly. Okay, Tuesday, Department of Revenue, agency presentation. That's always good. And then we'll start the Department of Revenue is going to, Commissioner Mark Cord and I think Joanna Bears are going to give a presentation on the governor's budget proposal. If that doesn't get done, Tuesday, we will make time in the future because we want to hear the entire governor's budget proposal. Wednesday, no meeting due to sexual harassment training. Why do I need that? That's Wednesday, right? Training? Okay. Thursday, Association of Minnesota Counties, Metro Counties, League of Minnesota Cities. I met with Matt Hilgert. He has, a really good presentation that would help the committee when it comes to counties and mandates and things like that. So that's what we're looking at next week. Then we'll start up bills. Again, this is so weird for me as a Republican chair to say, give me some DFL bills. And I thank you. You've done a few. So we want to get some in there. And to the Republicans, get me some Republican bills, your local stuff. Whatever you need there. So we will work with that. So before we adjourn, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is that Representative Joy's House File 5 got passed out of Transportation Committee. They called the question, actually, to rush it out of Transportation Committee, I believe. So when should we that happened this week, that we called the question in committee to move a tax bill out of transportation to taxes. So I'm just curious about when we'll be hearing House File 5.
Okay, Chair Gomez will be in our committee after session today.
Today.
Today, so it should be moved over to us. And I'd rather go 6 to midnight every night, including Saturdays and Sundays, to call a question. I don't like doing that, although I did ask to, you know, show some restraint yesterday to get a vote, but then I did get the room for another hour, but so I didn't have to cut anybody off. So that's kind of the way we do it in taxes. That's the way you did it. And so I want to continue that tradition. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the House File 5 will be in our possession today. And then when should we expect to have the hearing on it?
I haven't scheduled that yet. It won't be next week. But I'm guessing the next week we'll see If the DFL bills crowd that out, then I guess that's the way it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for the good of the order? With that, good government all the time, we are adjourned.